Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Eric Westervelt, and this is On Point. Two decades ago this month, the miseducation of Lauryn Hill revolutionized hip-hop and R&B. And though Miss Lauryn Hill is a more complex figure than ever today, her first and only solo album remains a groundbreaking achievement. The 1998 record tackled still-relevant feminist issues, won two Grammys, and paved the way for new generations of hip-hop and R&B artists. This hour, On Point, 20 years of the miseducation of Lauryn Hill. You can join us on air and online. Did miseducation make you a fan of Miss Lauryn Hill? Do you still listen to the album? Do you hear its echoes in today's hip-hop, R&B, and hop? Hip-hop. We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter or Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Woods Hole, Massachusetts, is Joan Morgan. She's the author of the book, She Begat This, 20 Years of the Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, which is being released today. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Joan Morgan, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Eric. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming in. Really appreciate it. And joining us from Culver City, California, NPR West, is Franny Kelly, co-host and producer of the hip-hop culture podcast Microphone Check on Spotify. Franny, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's hear a little more music. I mean, here's a bit of the song To Zion, the fourth track on the Miseducation album.
Whoa, this crazy circumstance. I knew his life deserved a chance, but everybody told me to be smart. Look at your career, they said. Lauryn, baby, use your head. But instead I chose to use my heart. Now the joy of my world is in Zion.
Joan Morgan, that's arguably one of Hill's most personal works. You write in your new book out today that miseducation for you and scores of fans really became a kind of soundtrack to your life back then, 20 years. Talk about what still captivates you about that song and about the album today.
Well, for Zion in particular, I was pregnant, so it had a lot of personal relevance, and I didn't realize then that many, many, many people are pregnant under what they consider less than optimum circumstances. I had a book that I was working on, a book that was going to drop while I was pregnant, just the whole nine. And so it had a lot of resonance to me in terms of being at a certain point in your career and trying to balance your life as a woman and a mother and make tough career and personal choices. But I also think that, you know, the album takes us back to a really wonderful breath of fresh air at a time in hip hop that was particularly trying. You know, the community is coming off the murders of Biggie and Tupac. Like, post 96 becomes a really rocky time for hip hop fans, with some rude awakenings. The misogyny in the music is making a lot of female listeners question, is there really a place for me in the music and the culture anymore? And I think the miseducation for a lot of us was a breath of fresh air.
A much welcomed pivot in some ways within the industry, within music.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. For sure.
What do you want listeners to know about your personal take on the album, besides that song Zion? What do you think listeners should know 20 years on about its relevance and resonance today?
You know, I tried to write the book as a cultural history, giving us an opportunity to look at where we were really at the end of the 20th century in terms of music, black music, hip hop and pop culture, but also politically, and why Lauren kind of ascended to this role of icon. And it wasn't just about the music. I think a lot of people burdened her with this role of saving the music, saving the genre, being the thing that was going to turn the music around. And it was a really heavy burden, I think, to place on a young woman that, I mean, was barely 23 years old. So, you know, I'd like us to look back and look at the miseducation and sort of be self-reflective and see where we were and own the love that we have, but possibly look back and ask ourselves some tough questions about unrealistic expectations.
Franny Kelly from Culver City, host of Microphone Check, welcome to the program. Well, talk a little bit about what you think the album, what message is it sent to listeners. This was a complicated album. It wasn't some simple pop or straight ahead hip hop. She mixed it up in a way that at the time was groundbreaking.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really useful to think of the album as a critique and a self-reflection. So it's as Joan says, you know, it's a critique of a lot of things that are happening in pop culture, in politics, and in hip hop specifically at that time, which I would say is a little bit more complicated in terms of what else was released that year. I mean, Black Star debuted Lyricist Lounge, first one, and Aquemini that year. So complicated conversations were happening all over the place. It's completely true that it was very male-dominated at that time. And so the way that Lauren came in, I'm sorry, that Ms. Hill came in and was fully herself, that she was vulnerable, that she would question some things that she had done in the past. A lot of the times it felt like she was talking to a younger version of herself when she was, in actual fact, you know, speaking to other people, to strangers. And I was, you know, I was a junior in high school when that happened, when it came out. And it really cut through the noise for me. You know, it really seemed like somebody could be flawed and still very successful. And it was very, I think it was inspiring for a lot of people to sort of to proceed on their own merits, on their own truth, and work it out, even if that has to happen in public.
Joan Morgan, take us back to that summer, you know, August 20 years ago. There were sort of rumors that something was coming out from Lauryn Hill, that she'd, you know, broken away from the Fugees and would do her own thing. Was there kind of a buzz about it? And tell us, you know, when you first heard it, was it kind of love at first listen, or did it take a while to grow on you?
Well, you know, one of the interesting things that happened to me when I was working on the book is that if you had asked me what the first single was from the Miseducation, I would have instinctively told you Lost Ones. And that actually isn't true. When you go back, there's no video for Lost Ones. There's a really interesting origin story, because the label didn't want to they didn't want the album as is. They were really critical of her approach diasporically to, like, different forms of black music, the mixing it up that's made the album so legendary. I spoke to Jason Jackson, who was her manager at the time and close friend, and Tommy Mottola didn't really want to touch it. And so then they just got really gangster with it and went to another label and had them press up vinyl of Lost Ones. And we heard Lost Ones everywhere. Like, they gave it to DJs. They gave it to, you know, it was on, like, the most hardcore hip hop shows. And so Lost Ones just it's like time stopped. It was just the definitive disc record. It isn't even a battle record, because there couldn't even be a response to it. And so it was Lost Ones, I think, that really captured the attention of those of us who were deeply immersed in the music at the time and really anticipating a release from Lawrence. And then, because the response to Lost Ones was so strong, it forced Sony's hand. And that's how the album actually came out.
And people had a deeply personal response to it. Let's go to some callers. They're lining up. Dina is calling from Parkland, Florida. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Eric. Thank you. When I heard that you were talking about this album and Lauryn Hill, my heart started fluttering. Spoke to me personally like a sermon directed towards me, and it changed the path of my life. I was a suburban housewife, pregnant, so sad and unhappy. Mm. I was in a marriage where I hated the guy, but I didn't have the courage to own it and face up to it and be honest. And her song, "I Used to Love Him, But I Don't Anymore." And then her singing about her love and her hope and aspirations for her new son, it resonated with me as a woman, as a woman who was struggling, as a woman who had ideals for herself, and it gave me strength and courage to go down that right path, and I did, and I'm living happily ever after. But her album, all her songs in that album are very dear to my heart, and I thank her for it.
Wow, thank you for sharing that with us. Joan Morgan, you know, as Dina mentions, many people had deeply personal connections.
They did. I think it's because it's a deeply personal album. Again, to refer to Jason Jackson, when I talked to him about this album, I think that a lot of people think about the album and they think that this is Lauren's Lessons Learned album. It sounds as if it comes from the soul of a much older person. But Jason, and I think this is probably right, describes this album as a sort of therapy for her, for where she would have wanted herself to be. So it feels really personal to us because at the time she is coming out of a very complicated relationship with Wyclef. She's already started. She's in a relatively new relationship.
Wyclef
with Rohan Marley.
Fugees, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And she's a new mother. So she is kind of, we're privy to her working it out on vinyl. Like that became her therapy, and I think that's the reason, is that it's speaking not just from truth, but like she's right in the moment and sharing it with us.
We've got to take a break. Joan Franny, stay with us. We're discussing the anniversary and impact of the 1998 album The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. Give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. You're listening to the Killing Me Softly from the album The Score. I'm Eric Westervelt. You're listening to On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
Hey, Asma.
Hey, Scott.
Another crazy week. We've got North Korea.
Yep, we got Russia.
Midterms.
And, of course, President Trump. And what happens whenever there is crazy news that erupts? We pop into the studio and break it down to make sense.
So if you see a headline,
we've discussed it.
It's the NPR Politics Podcast.
Ready or not, here I come. You can't hide. Gonna find you and take it slowly. Ready or not.
You're listening to On Point. I'm Eric Westervelt. We're marking the 20th anniversary of the critically acclaimed album, The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. You can join the conversation now. Are you still a fan of Lauryn Hill's? Have you seen her perform live anytime recently? Has she lost any of your favors since Miseducation came out? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. That was Ready or Not, another hit from the Fugees album, The Score. We're talking with Joan Morgan, author of a new book on Lauryn Hill, out today, and Franny Kelly, co-host of Microphone Check, a podcast on Spotify. Now, we talked about it a little bit. But let's listen to some of Lost Ones, a really energetic first track, kind of comes right out of the gate hard on Miseducation album.
It's funny how money changes situation. Miscommunication lead to complication. My emancipation don't fit your equation. I was on the humble, you on every station. Someone play young Lauren like she done. But remember not to game the one of the sun. Everything you did has already been done. I know all the tricks from bricks to Kingston. My ting done, major kingdom, one run. Now understand El Boogie, not violent. But if a thing test me, run for me, gun. Can't take a threat to me, newborn son. El been this way since creation.
Franny Kelly, talk a little bit more about Lost Ones. I mean, it's a kind of a bold track. Starts off the album, sends a strong message, and kind of captures, sets the tone in some respects for the album. Talk about if you like it, and if so, why?
Well, the best thing about Lost Ones, I think, is that it's this reminder at the top of an album that became became mainstream, that Lauren was a rapper. She was one of the best rappers of all time. And there's some ways in which the success of Miseducation, you know, lets us forget that. And as I recall, there was a slight sense of disappointment that there was so much singing on Miseducation. NPR actually aired a profile of Miss Hill in 2010, and for it, the reporter spoke to Jay Smooth, who remembered that people saying that we may have missed out on the greatest rap album of all time because Miss Hill chose to go this route. And what's really interesting, I think, about that 20 years later is that because I think Miss Hill came up sort of in the context of the Fugees, you know, two men, she was always... To me, it always sounded like she was in competition with them. She was beef with them. She would battle with them. And as Jones said, you know, Lost Ones, there's no coming back from that. That's game over.
Right.
And partly because of that, I think nobody was putting Miss Hill in competition with another female rapper. Or like not a specific female rapper. In the way that happens today, where the conversation is, you know, Nicki versus Cardi or Nicki versus anybody else. Mm. It really always felt like Lauren versus all the dudes, everybody. Mm. Like she could take anybody. And I think Lost Ones is such a strong reminder of that, that she, you know, her only real competition is herself. And also, you know, men that, you know, in her personal romantic life, I would describe as unnecessary. Mm-hmm. She's got a lot to deal with, to sort of own her, all of herself. So that's not easy for any woman to do.
Well said. Joan Morgan, I want to ask you, I mean, what I like about the album is that it does mix her powerful singing, beautiful lyricism with hip hop. It mixes it up. Were some people disappointed that it wasn't a pure hip hop album? It wasn't a pure singing album. It wasn't a pure R&B album. It mixed that. Do you think something was lost on that, or is that part of its power?
Yeah, a lot of people was disappointed. I was disappointed. Lloyd speaks strongest to me as an MC. Mm-hmm. I think she has a beautiful singing voice, but a lot of people have beautiful R&B singing voices. But as an MC, she is singular. So for me, it was the album, I felt like Jay did, like it was a missed opportunity to showcase a little bit more, you know, of her. For those of us who fell in love with her as an MC first, I do see El Boogie as a very different persona than Ms. Hill. I missed more of El Boogie on that album, for sure.
Interesting. Let's get some callers involved. We've got a lot of them here who want to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Andy is calling from Florida. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, what's your comment on Miseducation?
I just wanted to say that she came at a very important time, after all the violence that took away Tupac and Biggie. Mm-hmm. She provided, on the back end of the importance that the Bee Gees had in the 90s, it catapulted her as a triple threat, not only as an MC, but a beautiful vocalist and an amazing lyricist. She didn't have to be overly violent or sexual or anything like that, and it was just something that didn't get as much as exposure as it should have, maybe. Hmm. But definitely more exposure than, like, Black Star or other conscious rappers that came out at the time.
Hmm. Well, it certainly did well. It sold millions of records. Thanks for your call, Andy. We appreciate your comments. Alejandro is calling from New Orleans, from the Big Easy. Alejandro, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Eric. I just wanted to comment just how much I do, like so many people are probably going to say, love Lauryn Hill, and just seeing her influence just keep going. Speaking from New Orleans, the Hot 8 Brass Band down here has played with her on a number of shows very recently, so you see how that still influences music. And I just wanted to ask about the commentators. I heard that Ms. Hill took a... It was very hard for her to take on being this kind of social voice. And, you know, 5 days ago, Alexandria Cortez, the nominee for Congress in New York, mm-hmm. tweeted her album, lyrics from Everything is Everything. Hmm. And I just wanted to hear the commentators speak on just how that intergenerational bond has happened, and if Miss Lauryn Hill has kind of maybe come to terms with that.
Good points. Joan Morgan, you want to tackle that, and including the sort of continued influence on political consciousness today?
So, it's hard for me to speak about where Ms. Lauryn Hill is today. She doesn't really do that much in terms of contemporary interviews or media. The last time I interviewed her was for a cover story for Essence, and it was 10 years ago in 2008. So it will be interesting, you know, now at the 20th anniversary to see if we actually hear more from Ms. Hill. I would say that what appears to be intergenerational, this is the great thing about the album being 20 years old, right? So when you think about it, a lot of the people who were the original set of Lauryn Hill fans were in their 20s and 30s at that time. So there's a documentary now that's being done where the filmmaker actually tracked down all the kids on the snippets who are talking about their impressions of love. And they're all in their, like, you know, mid-30s. So that might have very well been, like, what that congresswoman was listening to, like, you know, as a late 20-something-year-old, potential candidate, yeah. Was listening to at the time.
Yeah, well said. Christine is calling from Vermont, Pittsford, Vermont. Christine, welcome to the program.
Hi, Eric. How are you?
I'm great.
Thank you for taking my call.
What do you remember about the album?
Well, when this album came out, I was in my teens, and I was kind of discovering myself as a visual artist and a writer and really as a woman. And when I saw the video for That Thing, and I saw this, like, strong, talented, beautiful woman standing there, like, standing in her truth and throwing down this raw, honest, emotional hip-hop, it was so inspiring for me. And I still have that same disc I bought back in 1998, and I'm still finding ways to relate it to my life as a woman today, and I still listen to it.
That's great. Thanks for your call. I appreciate it. Joan or Franny, I mean, people still listen to it today, but we have to address the big issue in the room, is that there wasn't the follow-up. There was never the giant follow-up. Was there, Joan Morgan, too much pressure? Was the success too big? Are there other issues going on there? Why the sort of inexplicable drop-off of Lauryn Hill?
I mean, I think that Lauryn herself is probably the only person that could really answer that. But for the things that we know, the factual things that we know that happened in her life, you know, she is a woman with 5 children at the time, now 6. And as someone who has 1 child, I can tell you how hard it is to work as an artist with even 1. She had a great deal of, you know, she made it known that one of her priorities was being first and foremost a very present mother, which, you know, I always say as a feminist, it's not that it's not true that we can't have it all. We generally can't have it all at the same time. So I think that was a conscientious choice. She got into a very sort of, right after the album was released, a very elongated lawsuit with people who she worked with.
Some of her producers, right?
Some of her producers about exactly how much producing they did. So that took its toll. She was then also indicted on for back taxes and served some time. That, I'm sure, took its toll. And then, you know, the public started to what, as they often do with, you know, we build up icons and then we kind of tear them down. So she develops a sort of problematic relationship with some of her audience. Very late shows for concerts. What people felt were uneven performances at concerts. And then wanting these like sort of standard renditions of the songs that they fell in love with, and they'd be performed like either really fast or remixed, or she'd flip it in a way that didn't feel familiar to the audience. So she falls out of grace with the audience a bit. And then Unplugged just, in comparison, just fell flat commercially and critically. So I think that all of those things together are part of the mix of weight. Although I hear from people who claim to know her well that she has enough music to put out 3 albums right now. So I'm still hopeful. You know, I'm keeping hope alive.
Interesting. Well, let's hear a later song from her, as you point out, not well-received Unplugged album. That's for critics and fans to determine for themselves. This is called Mystery of Iniquity.
Into the false witness, slandering the accused, planting the seed, openly showing he's being used to discredit, edit, headed for the alleged, smearing the individual, fearing the unsuspected, expert witness, the paid authority, made a priority to deceive the majority of disinterested peers, dodging duty for years, hating the process, waiting to return to their careers. Do we expect a system made for the elect to possibly judge correct, properly serve and protect? Materially corrupt, spiritually amok, oblivious to the cause, prosperously bankrupt, blindly to the blind, guilty never defined, filthy as swine, a generation pure in its own mind. Legal extortion.
Franny Kelly, the Unplugged album didn't go over well. Some critics and fans said, what's she doing with that guitar? She could have gotten a guitarist who could actually play really well. It wasn't well received critically or otherwise. Was that a blight, or do you think it was a bit unfair to judge that album too harshly?
You know, I'm not sure that I can sort of fairly answer that question. I can say that a lot of the criticism of Ms. Hill and her work was part of these bigger sort of tussles over what is allowed to be authentic, what counts as pop music, you know, what is a singer allowed to do, what is a hip hop artist allowed to do, and especially, you know, the ways that she was critiqued, like even in that clip that we just heard, you know, she's very direct about corruption. And people weren't quite ready to hear that, or not everybody. The bulk of her audience was perhaps a little bit off put by the times when she just really went there. And I think that's sort of been, for me, that was a big shock with when Miseducation came out, and then also with Unplugged, was the way that people took her and her success and, you know, use that to, you know, I would say nefariously advance some sort of divisive agendas. That was hard because for me, I felt like the score was kind of it happened within the circle of people who respected the music, respected the people and the culture. And then Miseducation, like, took her out to, like, just strangers. And all of a sudden, I felt, you know, unprotected in a way. There's things that you can say, you know, at home that when you say them in public, get you in trouble. And I feel like she was aggressed upon when she said some things in public. There was a story, I hesitate to even bring this up because it was very incredibly painful to just even hear. So I lived in Washington, D.C. when this album came out. Came out in August. Sometime around December, there was this like shock jock on the classic rock station who, right after somebody was convicted for lynching a man named James Boyd Jr. by dragging him behind a truck in Texas, he played a clip, this shock jock, of a song off Miseducation and said, no wonder people drag them behind trucks. He was fired and all that and outcry. But I heard that, you know, when it happened. And that was the first time that somebody had taken something that was pure and sullied it by pulling it into a conversation not even a conversation, you know, just a cesspool of hatred, for their own crazy purposes. Mm. And I think that it's important to remember that this record got sucked into, got sucked into the world of people that don't care about the music, don't know anything about the music, are only accessing it for their own ends.
Interesting.
Eric, can I say something about Unplugged? Because this was something that, because I tried to
Joan, briefly, because we got to go to a break, but okay, we can go on the other side as well.
I think it's really important to remember that Unplugged was not meant to be her second album. It's part of an MTV series where artists perform live. Mm-hmm. Generally, the artists have much more work than she do. So I think it was a creative snapshot that got judged as like a second album, and it really was not supposed to be that.
It wasn't the follow-up it was supposed to be, and it was judged too harshly for that, potentially. Stay with us. There's more to discuss. We're talking about the significance, legacy, impact, and beauty of the Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. You can join the conversation. Is Miseducation still relevant today? Do you want to hear more from Lauryn Hill? Join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Eric Westervelt. You're listening to On Point. I make a lot like a Sunni. Your diplomatic community and every ghetto community had opportunity. Went from hood shock to hood chic, but it ain't what you cop, it's about what you keep. And even if they're leaks, you can't capsize the ship, because I baptize my lips every time I take sips. You can get the money, you can get the power, keep your eyes on the final hour. Now you get the money, get the money, get the power.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Did cutting taxes actually grow the economy?
And what makes DJ Khaled the king of pop music?
The Indicator, a daily podcast where we tackle the big economic questions.
Let me be patient. Let me be kind. Make me selfish without being blind.
You're listening to On Point. I'm Eric Westervelt. We're discussing Lauryn Hill and the impact of her music on the world today and the music world. You can join the conversation. Which current artist reminds you the most of Lauryn Hill? How do you think she's being used, being sampled, being tapped today? Did Miseducation change modern music? How do you think it did? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. That was Tell Him off, of course, The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. We're talking with Joan Morgan, author of a new book on Lauryn Hill, out today, and Franny Kelly, co-host of the Microphone Check podcast, available on Spotify. Let's go to some callers. We've got a lot lined up. People want to talk about this album. Gracia is calling from Miami, Florida. Gracia, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Hi, Eric. I'm so excited about this program. I did have the unique privilege of seeing Lauryn Hill. I believe it was year before last for Art Basel. My friend Renee Cox invited me to her friend Kahande Wiley's party on the beach. He does one every year for Basel. Kahande is an extraordinary painter, probably most recently well-known for his portrait of Barack Obama. And Renee is a mixed media artist. Mm. And together we all watched her perform outdoors on the beach for about 250 people. Wow. I believe it was all new music, nothing I had ever heard before. And it was a big band, and she is tiny but was huge, commanded the whole outdoors, and it was just an extraordinary experience.
Wow, quite an opportunity there. That's great.
I have a feeling big things are coming from her soon.
Well, thanks for your comment, Joan Morgan. That might support your hope and the buzz that maybe there's quite a bit of music out there that she's written and is ready to drop.
Yeah, I hope so. I think that would be great.
Yeah. I do want to, Joan, follow up with you. I mean, there is that fear that, you know, will she be the J.D. Salinger of hip-hop? One big hit, and then poof, she's mostly gone. I mean, even this tour to support the 20th anniversary, she just canceled some dates in July and August, quite a few. Some fans, it might be trying, you know, their patience a little bit. She famously made people wait for a long time for a lot of her concerts. I'm just curious, you know, whether you think she's trying some fans' patience a little bit.
Yeah, she is trying some fans' patience a little bit. But, you know, this is not new with Lauren. So I feel like at this point, if you buy a concert ticket, you know, it's you know that you may have the experience of the last listener and you know, and get completely turned out and it'll be wonderful. Or you might be waiting a while. So I think at this point that fans are informed enough that they know that they're taking a bit of a risk about, you know, how she's going to show up or that day. In fairness, I probably do think that it's a good thing to show up on time for your concert dates. right. That's not an unreasonable expectation. But, you know, I think that to look at Lauren's contribution to Black music and popular culture just through the lens of the miseducation is a little short-sighted. I write that she is really as much of a visual intervention as she was a musical one. At the time that she came on in 1998, there were no women who looked like her. When she took that cover of Harper's Bazaar, Harper's Bazaar didn't put Black people on the cover. Like, there was this chocolate woman with dreadlocks surrounded by all these little Black kids on a high fashion, and what was at the time Lily White fashion magazine. Now we see Gucci models with short natural hair. We see Yves Saint Laurent models with cornrows. There was no natural hair movement when Lauren did her thing. Like, this is pre the digital age. You know, there was no hashtag of Black girl magic. She was, it wasn't that there weren't women who looked and dressed like her, but they were not lauded by the public. That aesthetic was not one that was really appreciated until she took the scene. And so I think the door that she broke down there is long lasting, and the impact there that she's made has been indelible. And we really see it now in this Woolrich ad that's running, where she's she's talking about her reflections about the album and wearing these beautiful Woolrich plaid coats. And, you know, it looks really normal to us now, but it's because she made that normal. It was not normal in 1998.
Great points about her sort of cultural and artistic broader impacts. And you mentioned, you know, this is pre-digital age and pre-social media when this came out. Is there an element, do you think, of folks' nostalgia when looking at this album for in some ways, a simpler time, maybe in music, maybe in our culture, maybe in society?
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting. I asked a lot of the people I interviewed about this album. Most people still love that. They'd say they'd still love the album. And I'd say, do you still play it? And pretty much everyone said that, you know, they had certain songs that they liked that they might reach for, but nobody really sat down and listened to it from beginning to end. And the album started to, but they're never upset when they hear it, like out in public if someone else is playing it. And it started to emerge to me like that really good friend you made from college who you are happy when you run into them, or high school, you're happy when you run into them and you want to know how they're doing, but you don't necessarily stay in touch on a day-to-day basis. And so I think for a lot of people, this album got them through a particular period of time, and they have very fond memories of it and a reverence for it, but not necessarily a day-to-day kind of engagement.
Well said. Let's listen to a little more music. Here's the song Superstar, where Hill sort of challenges fellow artists, musicians to inspire people with their work.
Music is supposed to inspire. How come we ain't getting no higher? What an artist should be. Should they be someone with prosperity?
concept of reality.
Frannie Kelly, I want to ask you, what's your experience with Lauryn Hill concerts over the years? Have they been hit or miss? What?
Well, you know, I knew where I was going. I knew what was possible, as Joan says. I was never,
you know, when you buy that ticket to a Lauryn Hill concert, it's a bit of a crapshoot, you're saying? You know what you're getting into? I mean,
you take the risk. Right. I mean, the last time I saw her, I think, was in, 2010. She played the, I forget the name of the tour right now. But she was actually meant to open for A Tribe Called Quest, mm-hmm. or they were going to open for her. And then, but she was late, so they, like, redid the whole stage. They pulled, or she was going to go first, and they pulled all of her instruments off and then set up for Tribe. And then she changed her mind. There was, like, this whole thing. And you know what? It was worth it. Like, I don't care. Yeah. I don't care.
Right. Rashad is calling from Boca Raton, Florida. We're talking about the miseducation of Lauryn Hill. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me. I remember miseducation of Lauryn Hill. I was in college DJing at the time. Mm-hmm. So, like, that album, just on its face with the lyrics and everything, was, I mean, it was magnificent. You know, I had the Talib Kweli, Black Star, and it really was a breath of fresh air. But also, I think it was more than just that. It was like it showed artists or people at that time that you just didn't have to be one way. I mean, it was still, it was a neo-soul album, it was a rap album, it was an R&B album, and that crossover ability that it had is really what we see in music today. Mm. You know, I think it's a brilliant move. I think that we still, you know, I think that a lot of artists are still chasing that Lauryn Hill feel, in the sense of the ability to cross over and have lyrics and stay true to themselves, you know. And she was still dealing with a lot of stuff, a lot of complexities in her own personal life. That's to be so great and still have to be human, you know. I don't think that everybody can really appreciate the complexities that a person has to deal with when on that level.
Rashad, good points. I appreciate your call. Thank you for your insights. And you talked about the influence today. So, you know, I mean, up-and-coming artists, including Rhapsody, who received a Grammy nomination for Best Rap Album in 2018, talked about Hill's role in sort of breaking down barriers, including gender barriers in hip-hop, and the impact miseducation, you know, had on her music.
So, like I said, she out-raps the guys. And a lot of times people like to put women in this box. You hear a lot of times, you know, she's good for a girl. Lauren was one of those females that erased that, for one. You know, with her solo album, The Miseducation, she said, a lot of times people focus too hard on trying to make a hit and less on finding themselves and doing music that's them. And I think about that album, that's what I appreciated most.
Joan Morgan, talk a little bit about it, the resonance today for current artists. It's not just Rhapsody, it's others as well, yeah?
You know, I think the moment that I realized Lauryn had really cemented a place in hip-hop culture that was still really relevant today was when Cardi and Drake sampled her. It was such an act of, like, reverence, you know what I mean, to include a sample. And I also think for many years, people were kind of afraid to do it because Lauryn remained so... The legacy just remains so untouchable. And to see these contemporary artists, like, really weave her into the fabric of what they're doing now was really kind of beautiful and telling to me, particularly because people compare and in many ways, pit Cardi's trajectory against Lauryn so much. It was really nice to see her pay that honor.
Well, let's take a listen to one of those samples, the rapper Drake's summer hit Nice For What off his new album Scorpion. He samples Hill's X Factor. Let's take a listen.
How can I explain myself?
Louisiana. Murder on the beat. Something for y'all to cut up to, you know?
Franny Kelly, if you would, talk a little bit about, you know, the impact Lauren's having on new artists today.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, to Joan's point, I think Nice for What is, like, is great. You know, everybody needed that. But Cardi's song, you know, Be Careful With Me, was really important for women. And X Factor, you know, is just so... It's so close to the bone, you know, for what it's like to deal with a man who just, like, isn't up to par. And I think that this happens in pop music and R&B and hip-hop a lot more. I think that, or I guess it just happens openly, and these works are celebrated. I think SZA's album, Control, is probably the most, like, direct line in terms of the ways that she's just sort of openly saying, like, essentially what Lauren was saying, you know, what you want might make you cry, what you need might pass you by. Just in the weeds with those emotions. But I think that Lauren's influence has a lot to do with this sort of multi-genre fearlessness with genre borders that people, you know, rock all the way to the bank these days. I think Frank Ocean... is an inheritor of some of her sort of flouting of the rules.
And a little more lyrically complex and things like that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I mean, just, yeah, personal mm-hmm. and visual. Mm-hmm. But with a prioritization of melody and harmony, you know, making sure that these ideas really worm their way into your heart and your, you know, are a part of you, the memories that you make. I think also, you know, J. Cole is somebody who's benefited from paths that she cleared in terms of being vulnerable and lyrical. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to go to some of our callers who are backing up here. We're running short on time. A lot of folks want to join in the conversation. We're talking about the paths cleared by Lauryn Hill, the miseducation of Lauryn Hill. Leah is calling from Virginia. Welcome to the program, Leah.
Thank you, Eric, for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Sure, welcome.
I was first introduced. Well, let me begin by saying I'm from rural America, certainly a white conservative country. You know, women are definitely do not have power here. Made pretty clear from social undertones that exist. And I was a first generation college graduate. I am certainly not the demographic that would be sort of the type of person that Lauryn Hill music was geared toward, nor Salt and Pepper or Missy Elliott and today Cardi. But those are all people that have really influenced me and my journey in life. I mean, I have an Ivy League education. I'm a strong, independent woman. I own several businesses now. Mm-hmm. My life has been dramatically changed by the music and inspiration of these strong women. And, you know, it goes far beyond a color barrier. It goes far beyond a socioeconomic barrier. It's quite an inspiration.
That's a great point. Thanks. Joan Morgan, the impact, you know, strong, independent women was certainly multiracial. That was an achievement as well.
Certainly. I would say Lauren was probably even surprised by how many people worldwide responded to this album. But, you know, here's the thing. I think that women have always known that we are strong and capable of some pretty mighty stuff. I think that in 1998, we had such a narrowing of the depiction of the kind of women that you saw come out of popular culture, particularly hip hop, that Lauren reclaimed it and gave us something very visual and lyrical and musical to latch onto. She's very good about speaking about how she actually comes from a long legacy of beautiful Black women artists who came before her. So, yeah, it doesn't surprise me that caller said that.
Sadly, we are out of time. Thanks to our guests, Joan Morgan and Franny Kelly. We'll go out with Doo Wop That Thing from The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. I'm Eric Westervelt. This is On Point.